Hi everyone, I'm Kay Jabelli.
I'm Freeze Bastoon, and welcome to Monopoly Attack. So, the past weeks, there's been a lot of movement in the edtech space, where Google, of course, is one of the main players. Very complex sector, but just this morning, the European Commission opened an investigation into Google's edtech practices. And earlier this month, there was the French Competition Authority adopting a settlement and commitment decision regarding Google's edtech rules. Also earlier this month, there was the UK Competition Authority starting a commitment procedure regarding the privacy sandbox that Google is implementing in Chrome. And then finally, we have some move in the Android decision, specifically as it relates to remedies, which Google just adapted. That's a lot, but today we'll try and find the common threads running through this. Of course, edtech is one of those threads, but there is perhaps a more fundamental thread, which is Google's larger approach to antitrust enforcement and compliance in Europe. So, okay, what should we start with?
Well, I think it's interesting that these are all kind of a new kind of enforcement. These are all commitments. These are all the gatekeeper, so to say, the dominant company, the defendant, having not adversarial approach with the regulator, but agreeing to change their conduct. And actually, once we get into it, it'll be interesting to see what kind of conduct we're talking about. I think in episode one, we discussed conduct that is kind of internal to the firm, more like product design decisions, versus conduct that is a bit more external to the firm, agreements with suppliers and customers and competitors. And the extent to which that is a common theme in these commitments as well. And so the commitments are intended to close an antitrust investigation where there have been allegations or concerns that there may be anti-competitive conduct occurring in the market. And the defendant or the company that is under investigation will come forward and say, look, we might not agree with these concerns, but in order to resolve this case, have some legal certainty and be able to continue to operate without this cloud of enforcement action hanging over our heads, we're willing to make these behavioral changes, change our conduct, do things differently, which is sometimes criticized when these kind of behavioral commitments require long-term monitoring, which comes into play a little bit here, and the extent to which they require monitoring and information, oversight, reporting, and involvement from the regulator.
I think that's definitely the biggest thing we're seeing here, maybe cooperative antitrust. I'm sure I've read this term somewhere before. Someone must have coined it before me. If that term has not been coined before, you could also call designer antitrust, because the remedies here are quite specific. We really see those competition authorities getting into the weeds of this, again, super complex edtech space. Now, before we discuss that more, should we go into some of these commitments, investigations a bit more in detail, sort of a short rundown and see what they have in common?
Sounds good, yeah. And for those who look into this kind of concept into a little bit more detail, sometimes it's phrased also as participative antitrust or regulatory dialogue. But Frizo, I got to say, designer antitrust, mwah, chef's kiss. I'm going with that from now on.
All right, deal. That's our term now. Okay. Well, the first one that I've mentioned was the commission investigation, but maybe we should skip over that a bit because it's not entirely, it's just been announced and the cooperation or the level of participation there isn't yet as clear. So maybe start off with the French decision that was issued on June 7th, so a couple of weeks ago. And it's quite interesting that it's, on one hand, a settlement. So Google agreed to pay a fine of $220 million, not a small amount, but also a commitment decision where Google agreed to implement certain changes to its ad tech rules. And those that case was spurred by a number of press groups, including News Corp, well known for its owner Rupert Murdoch. And these press groups, of course, interact with Google's ad tech stack, as they call it, a complex system that has a lot of moving parts to it, but it has an ad exchange in the middle, it has an ad server, and it also has this double click for publishers component, which is sort of the tool that publishers use to interoperate with the ad exchange. Did I get that more or less right, Kay?
I appreciate that you've done an amazing job, Friso, as a non-technical expert. Despite my years of study in computer science and engineering, did not get into detail on the ad tech stack myself either, so I'm no expert. There's a lot of people who have been trying to unpack it. I know it's infamously complicated. I think at one conference, Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, said, yes, it's really complicated. And there's a lot of auction-based programmatic decision-making going on that allows dynamic placement of ads at, you know, the best, most effective price that are the most tailored and designed to be reaching the audiences that are most likely to respond to those ads, to appreciate those ads. That happens every time you load a page or hit refresh or, you know, go to a new link website, all kinds of ads that are showing up also, you know, in your newsfeed or variety of other places on the web and on mobile, that this is all happening sort of behind the scenes. There's a lot of processing power and computer resources that are devoted to having these work to maximize the possibility of monetizing content. You know, once we start making those big bucks with all that advertising that we'll have on this podcast, we'll be playing in that system where we want our content to get monetized to the best price that we can get. And that involves a lot of data-based decision-making.
Right, yeah. And an analogy that might be helpful here is a stock exchange. Of course, Google has an ad exchange at the middle of all of this. And really, in split seconds, when we load a web page, that ad space on that web page, for example, this news website, has to load, has to be auctioned off first. And that happens so fast. So it's reminiscent of his book, Flash Boys. It all has to happen in split seconds. And as you said, there's a lot of information to take account of. Who are we serving it to? Who is serving it? And how can that be the best match? And perhaps take this analogy a bit further. Google is active in most of the parts of that system. So in the middle and the exchange, but also on the demand and the supply side. And I guess at the basis of this case is sort of this idea that it is abusing its interoperability, the way these parts interact with each other. It sometimes does so explicitly through increased interoperability, just making those parts work better together. It also happens through the use of data, namely one notable asymmetry there is this double click tool that I've talked about, that the price offered by these competing platforms, other tools to this ad exchange, that tool owned by Google had sort of an advantage because it got the information from the exchange and could then optimize how it bids in the exchange mediated auction. So again, I'm already hearing myself and getting almost lost. It's complex, but that's more or less the heart of the case, right?
I do think there's quite some differences with the traditional stock exchanges. So for one, the data shows that the longer it takes to load a page, including advertising on that page, the less likely users are to interact with it. So there is a broader interest in having efficiencies in the tech stack, having integrations that mean that the pages, the ad auction mechanism, that all these steps in this chain are operating in a way that will mean users are more likely to click on the ads, which helps everyone. So, you know, as we've been talking about with a lot of these cases, there are some trade-offs at play here. And the question is sort of, how do you balance what is going to be good for the overall ecosystem and the growth of demand and usage and what is going to be good for some participants in that ecosystem? And at the same time, how do you distinguish between conduct or integrations that are truly good for the whole ecosystem versus those that are good for the one making the rules?
That's definitely a complex area with trade-offs, including maybe the privileged access of Google, at least in some layers of the stack, might have an efficiency defense, but they didn't go all the way in really pleading that out until the end. Rather, they offered commitments. And what do those involve?
It's interesting to take a look at the different interpretations, the press statements from the French Competition Authority and Google, because they take a kind of a different approach to it. I see a lot from the French Competition Authority that's like, they've agreed to make things fair. And Google's description of it is more of, well, we continue to ensure that things are fair. So it's a little bit of a framing differences going on. But in terms of the actual commitments, one of them is that Google will implement product changes that improve interoperability between their ad tech product, Ad Manager, and third-party ad servers. So that seems like an interesting market power question, because on the one hand, the French Competition Authority has identified concerns that their level of interoperability is not enough to promote competition. To some extent, it could be improved to increase competition or at least increase the functionality and efficiency of rival services. And then the question is, so what is the special obligation of a dominant company to develop its technologies in a way that benefits competitors? And that line that now is going to be what would normally be in the ex-ante decision-making of the company, where they would consult with their internal lawyers and say, oh, well, you know, this is where we think we want to draw the line given the scrutiny we're under and the risks of enforcement and that. Whereas in this case, they're basically saying, okay, given the scrutiny we're under and the risks of enforcement, we'll let you decide, French Competition Authority. We'll open this up to you to tell us what kind of level of improved interoperability, you know, what is our special responsibility here?
There's a whole list of commitments to go through, but that's definitely an interesting one. Unless you want to sort of stick around this, maybe we could take a look at what the UK Competition Authority is doing as well with a sort of similar ex-ante procedure, a commitment decision.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. Now, this one is not so much about the ad tech stack, well, it relates to it for sure, but it's about this so-called privacy sandbox that Google has been planning for a year or two and is now close to implementing. It's a change driven perhaps a bit by Apple, which has been promoting privacy as a fundamental human right and whatnot, has implemented a lot of changes such as app tracking transparency, IDFA changes, etc., which we talked about a bit in the first episode. So now Google is sort of following up with its own privacy changes, where one of the most interesting ones is keeping a lot of data in the so-called privacy sandbox. So there would be a decrease or even a blocking of third-party cookies that allow websites, apps, etc., to follow you around the web. So the shift would be towards these first-party cookies, where the websites that you're itself visiting and inserting data in, just simply browsing, would still have access, but third parties, well, that would largely be gone. Although it's important to note that this is at the planning stage and the CMA, the UK Competition Authority, got involved before anything was actually implemented. So another example of this designer antitrust, the CMA being involved with how exactly the privacy sandbox will be designed, because there is a concern that some advertisers, for example, these news websites, etc., that might rely on third-party cookies would be disadvantaged by these changes, and that Google, most of all, would be the one to benefit.
Yeah, a lot of the same publishers that have raised concerns also with regards to Apple and their privacy changes. I think what's interesting about this privacy sandbox, I think to take a step back, because this cookie proposal, the changes of the phasing out of cookies and coming up with new ways of maximizing the ability of advertisers to make revenues while at the same time protecting users' privacy. This is all sort of core trade-offs that Google has been wrestling with since they announced that they were considering this back in August of 2019. And what's really interesting to me is the privacy sandbox isn't this kind of, this is what we're doing. It's a collaborative open source effort to develop new technologies. And there's a lot of other developers, different proposals, right? So different approaches to this. And there's a lot of blog posts that Google has published on this topic and their plans and different ideas. And so it's been a kind of a open development process with industry stakeholders, other players in the ad tech stack and customers. And now it's not only going to be an industry forum, a collaboration between industry players, but now the competition authorities are also going to be involved in this to decide, you know, how do you find this balance between user privacy and making sure that publishers can continue to have free content that's advertising funded.
Another party involved with this, it's not just the UK Competition Authority, the CMA, but also the Information Commissioner's Office, or the Data Protection Supervisor of the UK. And an interesting aspect to that is that, you know, there's long been sort of a firewall between competition and data protection. The commission made a lot of statements in that regard in earlier decisions, but that firewall is sort of breaking down. We've seen that first in Germany, of course, with the Facebook decision. Now also in the UK, where they really promote this as, you know, further evidence of this collaborative partnership between two regulators and the close relationship between the interests of competition and data protection. Quite a bold statement on two branches of law, which they try to keep apart for at least some time. But that now seems inevitably changed.
Yeah, and I think we see a bit even more of that if we get to talk about the case that the commission confirmed that they've opened today. In today's news, where they also talk about data protection as influencing the competition analysis. But yeah, the idea that the UK Competition Authority has brought in the Data Protection Authority to take part in this dialogue and this design of the product, of the approach to increasing privacy, and particularly with respect to third-party cookies, I think is really interesting. And we're part of a growing trend, like you said. And another aspect is that we already talked about how this is happening before any changes have been made, and obviously without a finding of infringement, because nothing has happened yet. So it's hard to have an infringement when you haven't done anything. But the fact that this has gotten to this stage of commitments in a pretty short amount of time. I mean, there's a lot of criticism of antitrust taking too long, but this is antitrust. This is not new powers that the UK authority has. You know, this isn't under the DMA or any UK equivalent. And yet the case was opened on the 8th of January, and now already the commitments are being market tested. So, you know, 6 months to open a case and have on the table changes to the way the company is going to be operating in the market, and having that commitment to have the competition authority involved. And obviously, the UK leading on this means that the other competition authorities will want to be involved, and maybe that plays into the latest announcement from the European Commission, because these will likely have implications for what Google does in the privacy sandbox globally. You know, it's unlikely that this is just going to be a UK solution in terms of the balance that the UK authorities find appropriate. And so I wonder how that inter-agency dialogue between the CMA and other competition authorities or other data protection authorities, who we know many are looking into this conduct when we talked about it on episode one, how that's going to play out.
For sure. And I mean, another interesting aspect, if you look at these commitments, sort of that it has both like hints to exploitation as well as exclusion, which is the more traditional or more popular branch of antitrust, at least Article 102. I mean, they talk about unfair terms in the privacy sandbox, a potential transparency issue that will then be solved, the combining of individual user data, which we know from the German Facebook decision. And then, of course, there's the self-preferencing aspect, the commitment that Google will not discriminate against rivals in favor of its own advertising and ad tech businesses when designing or operating the alternatives to third-party cookies, so operating what comes after, which Google itself has put forward as a no self-preferencing commitment. And all of that within the next 60 days.
I think Google, like with the French case as well, Google has their own press release on this. And the way they've described the commitments, I think, is quite interesting. I mean, it's a very principled approach. They say, look, we're not going to give our advertising products a data advantage, and we're not going to self-preference. And then they go into detail on how those are principles that they have always had policies for, as they say, and how they will continue to follow those policies. And, you know, I think it's tricky when the theory of self-preferencing is somewhat ambiguous. What, you know, what are the limits of self-preferencing? And I suppose reasonable minds can differ on whether something is or is not self-preferencing. So maybe in Google's mind, they never did any self-preferencing and they have always followed these principles. And maybe on the competition authority's mind, well, at least we know with regards to the European Commission, they take a different view of that. So I think as principles, it also kind of matches what the UK approach to amending competition enforcement has been. They talked about wanting to have these high-level principles. In the last three episodes, we talked about the DMA being very prescriptive with these form-based prohibitions. But the UK approach to amending and reforming competition enforcement has taken something that's more effects-based, more tailored, and more principles-based with high-level codes of conduct that then will be implemented, you know, the specifics to the business models of the platform that is under scrutiny will be taken into account.
That is an interesting difference. And
I'm looking forward to reading this 95-page notice of intention to accept binding commitments that the CMA published. So I'm sure there will actually be some quite interesting details on that. But unfortunately, I didn't have time to take a look at that for this episode.
And of course, the CMA sort of knows what they're talking about after their very in-depth study of these ad tech markets. So I suppose if there's one regulator ready to tackle this complex situation, it would be the CMA.
And that's quite what Google calls out in their blog about it. They appreciate the CMA's thoughtful approach that will involve a thorough review and engagement with the difficult trade-offs that this process involves. I don't know if that's a little bit of shade thrown at some of the other approaches out there, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out geopolitically.
For sure. And in the third development concerns Android, of course, a decision that was already adopted by the Commission in 2018, but ever since then, we've seen criticism, I mean, essentially from day one that Android adopted, or Google adopted its Android remedy in the form of choice screens that involved an auction. So eligible search engines had to bid to be included in this choice screen that was shown to users of Android phones, which represented three or five choices. I'm not exactly sure anymore. But according to critical search engines, that was sort of a margin squeeze situation where, you know, in order for them to be able to compete in the way that the commission intended, they actually had to pay up, and any sort of benefit they would have from being in that choice screen was already paid away to be included. So after 3 years of back and forth, we see this pretty radical redesign where Google announces that henceforward, or at least in a little bit of time, participation in this choice screen that they've been running will be free, and it won't be based on the highest bids, but rather there will be room for the five most popular search engines per country, and then seven additional ones. And there's a lot of details on how those will be chosen.
I think the leading up to this, the background is really, from a competition lawyer point of view, it troubles me a bit, because the commission found that Google actually wasn't making any money from these auctions. And obviously, if you're a remedy taker, an access seeker, if you're a beneficiary of these choice screens, you're constantly going to be saying, well, why am I not getting enough clicks? You know, I need to be getting more clicks. They're doing something nefarious. You know, they're not putting me at the top. That's unfair. I should be at the top. I should be getting all the traffic. And that has been a powerful narrative being pushed by these complainants to say, look, these choice screens aren't working, they're not complying, this is supposed to create a different market outcome, but why aren't we getting users to use our search engine? Clearly, the remedy of Android was ineffective, and that's why, Commission, you need to step in and do something. Commission has, you know, sometimes pointed to market shares of competitors, the amount of clicks going to competitors in the Google Shopping case, the remedies discussion there, they said, well, you know, we see that a lot of competitors are getting clicks, so that seems to be working. I'm a little bit nervous about that kind of thing because it hides the personal autonomy of people who are making these choices, right? Like, there is still that possibility that people are choosing Google because they like to use Google search. They might find it to be a better search engine. That's a possibility. I mean, I'd say it's a reality, but in terms of...
I'd have to push back on that a little. I mean, because by that logic, people also choose Bing when it happens to be installed as the default. I mean, and if those users don't switch either, like, I mean, then that means Bing is somehow the best search engine for those users. But it, I mean, the best search engine always seems to be the one that's pre-installed. So it's difficult to really draw lessons about their respective quality from that.
Yeah, and there's decision costs involved and sort of like learning costs and switching costs. I mean, using a search engine, they all basically are used in the same way, so there's not a whole lot. But there's a lot of reasons why people might not want to switch. They might not see the marginal value of that different service as that much better than the costs of using a different service. They might see a very small difference in quality. But yeah, there is a possibility that choice screens, that user interfaces can be designed in a way that is nudging users towards a certain outcome, and that can be problematic. And so they've kind of made that allegation pretty impossible to maintain, at least as far as the Android choice screen is concerned.
True. I mean, I think this really is an improvement, because when I looked at this choice screen remedy a year ago, Google always publishes these lists of who won the auction for that quarter. I believe it was a quarterly auction. And of the search engines you saw there, you barely knew half of them, because it was all these random search engines that you never heard of that were, if you visit their website, really crappy. I mean, I don't know where they got their search technology, but at least they loaded the page with truly so many ads. I mean, Google, by comparison, was almost looked at free. And of course, that made sense, because with a really ad-loaded search engine, you make more money off those ads and you can put in higher bids in that quarterly auction. And then, yeah, it seemed like at least some people must have gotten stuck with a crappy ad-loaded search engine. So that should change if the most popular search engines are now part of the mix. So I guess that would include Bing, DuckDuckGo, maybe Ecosia, the eco search engine. We'll have to see.
I think it's interesting what your priors are on that one, because you're thinking of the remedy as promoting competition. It sounds to me like you're saying, well, what Google should have done in the original design is not cease the infringement, but create competition.
I would say restore competition. That's the whole goal of a remedy, right? If the commission and then the courts find that indeed this was a distortion of competition, then you have to take that away somehow. And I guess the auction remedy wasn't really doing that.
That is going to have to be a debate for another episode. Restorative remedies. What is the line? You know, there are differences of opinion on that, but that's effectively what they're doing now, right? You're looking on it approvingly because it's more likely to restore competition and go beyond merely ceasing the infringement. Do I understand that?
I think, yeah, there should be a goal with remedies to sort of restore to some extent what that distortion has caused, yeah.
I think it's interesting that this isn't being done as an initiative of the commission. It's not that the commission said, you failed to restore competition, and we've opened the proceedings against you for failing to comply with your remedies. This has been a voluntary, obviously in light of much heavy lobbying and criticism from those who stand to benefit from this, but still ostensibly a voluntary change that they've agreed to do. And so specifically from September, users will be presented with a scrollable list of up to 12 eligible general search services, which will appear in random order. The first five will be the most popular in that location in the country, and according to a third party, StatCounter, and will be displayed ahead of the next seven, which will be randomly ordered. There's no longer a requirement to participate in an auction to be placed. This is purely a free choice screen, and any search engine subject to some sort of rather limited quality criteria, like operating search in the language of the country where you want to be shown. And obviously, users still have the freedom to go ahead and change whatever they want in subsequently. It's not something that's set in stone. And I think it's interesting also that this is a change that's limited to Google products. So speaking of the obligation to promote competition, they're not forcing OEMs to implement this on all possible aspects of the handset. So OEMs are still free to have a pre-installed and default browser that they can monetize by offering that to competitors. This is only going to affect the Chrome search. And on devices where rival search providers are exclusively pre-installed, as in when there is no Google search app, then the choice screen will not be displayed.
Yeah, I think in its current form, the remedy gets close to what we saw in the Microsoft browser cases, where there was also a free choice screen with the most popular options. So we're sort of getting to a very similar remedy here. Do you have concluding thoughts, or should we quickly take a look at what the commission is doing before we sort of draw broader lessons about all of this?
Well, on this case, I think it'll be really interesting to see what the effects are, right? So there are all these allegations of bias and self-preferencing, and this could be potentially a real experiment of seeing who do people choose to use when it's presented in this way. And I think the way this choice screen is going to be presented, it's going to be hard to make that allegation that there's some kind of dark pattern here, there's some kind of nudging or any kind of self-preferencing going on between the Android's choice screen and people using Google search. So we'll come back and talk about it in 6 months, I suppose, and see what is the uptake. Are competitors, like you said, DuckDuckGo and Ecosia and such, still complaining? Like, what will they complain about then? Like, what more can they ask for, really? And at what point does the competition authority have to say, all right, these are just competitors trying to engage in rent seeking?
Yeah, that'll be material for a follow-up episode. Okay, now, of course, the commission literally today started its own, or announced its own investigation, but that is not really part of the designer antitrust team, at least not yet. We'll see if Google offers commitments there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that there's a lot of this stuff overlapping, that the commission is now opening an investigation formally so they can say, hey, you need to consult with us as well. Don't just talk to the French authority. Don't just talk to the British authority. The German authority is also open similar parallel cases. So the commission definitely wants to be in the room when these decisions are being made and not just leave it for other regulators to have the last say, so to say, on how Google designs its products.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You do see a lot of components in there, some about the privacy sandbox specifically, for example, overlapping with the UK. Of course, that overlap is no longer a problem since the UK, I suppose, is no longer bound by its regulation 1/2003 that has some priority rules in it. But participative antitrust or designer antitrust, what do you think motivated Google to take this different tack? I mean, obviously, they're still fighting some of these decisions on appeal, specifically the Android one. But in the meantime, it seems like they take a much less adversarial approach, seem more ready to engage with these enforcers in designing remedies together.
I think it's a reality that they're just trying to face that the decisions over these products that affect millions, billions of users potentially, are no longer solely in their hands. And competition authorities around the world are taking interest in this. They're going to be suffering from complaints, regardless of what they do. And I mean, even if you go back, this isn't new, right? The privacy sandbox, there's so many blogs and transparency constantly talking about, look, this is what we want to do. I mean, they knew this was going to result in complaints and likely a competition investigation. And so, you know, trying to do right, I suppose. And whether you think of that as a change of position or more of a acknowledgement of the wider role they play in the digital economy, or if you take a cynical view and think that they're just trying to get ahead of some of these investigations and these cases and they want to try to resolve them as amicably as possible, I think it's just a sort of a reality of what you have to think about when you're as big as these companies are now?
Yeah, I think the getting ahead of some stuff is interesting. I read this certainly short Twitter analysis of the Politico reporter Nicholas Hurst, and his view was that it was hard to tell for sure whether Google has turned the page in Europe, opting for peace, not war, or is this a surprising new stance, just risk management for the biggest risk of all, U.S. litigation, where perhaps remedies going as far as breakup could be imposed. At least there has been a tradition of that. But another thing it made me think of was this podcast with the former general counsel, now I believe vice president of Microsoft, who sort of described the six levels of antitrust hell that Microsoft went through and that Microsoft is now seeing its colleague tech companies going through, where at first you fight everything, but then you sort of let go of that stance and try to come to a solution more participatively. And at least in his telling, Microsoft came out of that for the better, but that might be a bit of a hindsight bias. But yeah, maybe Google took some inspiration from that as well.
In terms of whether it's peace, not war, peace takes two sides. I think it'll be interesting to see whether the rhetoric around these companies being, you know, out of control monopolies that need to be crushed or tamed or broken up and da-da-da, whether that public sentiment will change at all with this. I fear that that sentiment is stoked a lot by these kind of self-interested players. And so maybe this isn't really a signal for peace, but rather just, you know, submission and commitments and hope for reason.
We'll have to see. I guess we are at the top of the hour. Should we conclude here or?
Sounds good. Thanks everyone for listening to episode 5 of Monopoly Attack, and looking forward to continue the conversation with you.